Today's February 16th. We're here Thursday mornings at JCC learning Jewish thought, providence, and theodicy. We're now in the section dealing with the Middle Ages, medieval Jewish thought, and we're right smack in the middle of the Rambam, the Guide to Perplex. We said that when we finish the Rambam, the other thinker representing the Middle Ages we'll see is the Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershom, but that's a few weeks in the future. So here in the Guide, we're going to review a small part of what we did last time. We ended up with 475 and 476. Let's read that again. It's the bottom of 475 we're going to begin, not at the top, but the bottom, where it says, consider. Okay, everyone has the place. Those who don't have the place can listen. 475 at the bottom. Consider in what way the texts of Scripture speak of Providence watching over the details of the circumstances of the patriarchs in their various activities and even in their acquisition of property, and what they were promised in consequence of Providence accompanying them. It was said to Abraham, I am thy shield, to Isaac, I will be with you and will bless thee, and to Jacob, behold, I am with thee and will keep thee where whichsoever thou goest, and to the master of the prophets, which is Moshe, certainly I will be with thee, and to Yeshua, as I was with Moshe, so I'll be with thee. All these are explicit affirmations of Providence watching over them according to the measure of their perfection. With regard to Providence watching over excellent men and neglecting the ignorant, it is said, he will keep the feet of his holy ones, but the wicked shall be put to silence and darkness, for not by strength shall man prevail. So let's remember what the Rambam is emphasizing here. We said that Providence, according to the Rambam, is a function of the divine intellectual overflow. Remember that word, overflow. Overflow, in our terms, if we want to speak of it metaphorically related to modern technology, overflow is broadcast. That there is a constant, continual broadcast throughout the universe of knowledge. Knowledge is there, it exists, it's waiting for us to latch onto it, which means, according to the metaphor, to have the radio receiver that will get the broadcast. The broadcast is always there. Divine knowledge is God. God is knowledge. God is the intellect. And that knowledge of all things that are everlasting, everything about creation, is flowing down through the way stations, which we said are the
spheres,
the planets are the bodies that have souls. The souls are called the separate intellects. That's the soul of the planets, and they're understood to be, for our purposes, the way stations that transmit the broadcast down to Earth. We learned that prophecy, for a moment I'm not talking about providence, but prophecy, we learned that prophecy is nothing more, nothing less than the intellect being perfected to the point at which it's able to perfectly or almost perfectly receive the broadcast. That's what prophecy is. It's the highest level of human intellect, the highest development, which means that you have fine-tuned your transmitter so that it gets the most available amount of knowledge that is out there that is being broadcast. Remember we said also that prophecy is a completely natural phenomena. There's no special divine intervention that allows the prophet to be the prophet. Rather, if the prophet perfectly, or as perfectly as possible, develops his intellect, he will necessarily get prophecy without any special divine decision, except for the fact. Anyone remember the one caveat in which God does get involved?
Turn it off.
Right? God can prevent someone from getting prophecy. Not to turn off the broadcast, but to turn off the receiver. And that's the way the Rambam brings God in a, you could say, supernatural fashion into prophecy. But besides the possibility that God can theoretically turn off your receiver, other than that, the process is completely naturalistic. And it's important to talk about prophecy in the context of providence, because the Rambam seems to be saying that providence is really part and parcel of the exact same mechanism that prophecy is. Which means that when you fine-tune to the greatest possible degree, your receiver, that is to say your intellect, and you get the divine knowledge, you receive the broadcast, you connect to the overflow and fill your cardboard box, your soul, your broadcaster, with divine knowledge, that in some sense, that the Rambam didn't say explicitly how, that is providence. That is providence. And we said last time, the time before, that what the Rambam seems to be saying, although he doesn't say it explicitly, is that when you are filled with such a degree and breadth of divine knowledge, the providence that watches over you is self-interest, is responsible behavior, is knowledge of circumstance and the way the world works, so that you're able to avoid pitfalls and maladies and, to a certain degree, disease and chance evil occurrences. And to many of us, this might seem like a sleight of hand, like a trick of language, like semantics. That's providence? No, that's not providence. You might say that's just human responsibility. But why can the Rambam call it providence? Well, I think the most important point is that this is providence in the sense that God, according to the Rambam, has created the universe in such a fashion that those people who perfect themselves are able to live a better life, protected from most of the evils that befall us. In other words, the universe is created and calibrated so that goodness on your part brings about a result of receiving goodness. If you're good, and again, according to the Rambam's definition of goodness, which is perfection of intellect, you will almost necessarily be rewarded by perfection of circumstance. That's providence, and this is, look how wonderfully created and calibrated this universe is. There's almost a one-to-one correspondence between your behavior, your understanding, which is your behavior, and what you get. That's just wonderful. That's beautiful. That's an unbelievable sign of the divine perfection of the whole structure. Look how well it works. In that sense, it's providence. Dorothy.
So, how does the Rambam explain that scholars get sick and...
Wait. We'll get to it. Stuff. We'll get
and
to
how
it.
How does he explain the prophets, like, I think it was Amos, who had no book knowledge at all?
On that, the Rambam would say you're wrong.
You said it was...
It's impossible.
But the...
That's what the Rambam was saying.
Don't worry about the text. The Rambam will reinterpret the text. The Rambam says it's as likely that an ignorant man would be a prophet as that a dog would speak.
I understand what he says, but we have literature that contradicts you.
So the Rambam would answer that the gates of interpretation are always open.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I understand. Of course I understand what you're saying.
Did the Rambam believe that every human being had the capacity to improve himself or perfect himself?
That's a good question.
I know he thought that he didn't have to be Jewish to be a prophet.
The Rambam was an elitist on two levels. One, that only those who perfect their intellect are worthy of being called human beings. And secondly, the Rambam certainly believes there are certain races that are not capable of perfecting their intellects.
Really? Which races?
Let's leave it at that. I'm being recorded here.
Yeah, you caught the Rambam.
But of course, in the Rambam's racial theory, he was not innovating anything that wasn't believed 100% by the science of his day. So, let's go on. Remember, this is basically review. We're at the top of 476. Second line, it says thereby that the fact that some individuals preserve from calamities, whereas those before others, is due not to their bodily forces and their natural dispositions, this being the meaning of the dictum, for not by strength shall man prevail, but to their perfection and deficiency, I mean their nearness to or remoteness from God. Right? If bad things happen to you, in most cases, says the Rambam, it's because you haven't perfected your intellect, and therefore you're not at that moment, at that time, being watched over by Providence. Whereas those people have perfected their intellects, those people, when their intellects are perfect, are by definition, being watched over by Providence. Now, remember, picking up where Mo just brought us with the Rambam's elitism, most human beings, according to the Rambam, are not human beings. They haven't perfected their intellect. Remember, he said it's a light thing to kill them. That certainly stuck in your minds, right? Because they're just like animals.
It's a new definition of
it's an old definition. Wait, let me finish the thought. And just like animals are not, and the Rambam emphasizes this again and again and again, are not watched over by Providence, so let me just pick a number out of a hat. 90% of human beings are not watched over by Providence because they're not human beings.
Well, but that wasn't my question.
I know, but I'm just using it as a stepping stone.
No, my question was, is everybody capable of perfecting
themselves? I understand, so I said that there are some races that are not.
That I understand. I understand that's what you said. But if you were among the races that could perfect themselves, was everybody endowed with the ability or the capacity to do that and chose not to?
Right, that's a very good question. It's complicated, but to make a long story short, a lot of scholars believe that the Rambam promulgated the 13 principles of faith to deal with Mo's question. In other words, and I'll just say this shortly, many people, even if they're from the races whose cardboard boxes are theoretically primed to absorb knowledge, most people cannot be philosophers, whether because of their IQ or because of their circumstances. So the 13 principles of faith are meant to be a summary of philosophical truth so that everyone can fill their boxes with the minimum and therefore have some degree of intellectual perfection. Is that enough intellectual perfection to gain for them Providence? Doesn't look like it. Right? Jay?
Then, therefore, this would be subject to a very simple test to see if it's true. That is, those people who've in fact fulfilled the Rambam's criteria, then, does any of those people ever have bad things happen to them?
Right, and the Rambam will deal with that at the very end of the Guide to Perplexed. And that's why, after we go from pages 492 to 497, we're skipping to 621, at the end of the guide, where he comes back to this and tries to answer that question, which is similar to what Dorothy just put up. Right. But Jay is right. According to the Rambam, Nobel Prize winners should be rewarded with Providence, and according to the Rambam, they are. So when bad things happen to good people, usually the Rambam's answer will be they're not really people. Providence is not watching over them because they haven't perfected themselves to be people. And they're on the level of animals. It's their fault. That's what you said. It's their fault.
Would he consider them created but shall not again?
No.
He wouldn't.
Sorry I said that, but that's what the Rambam says.
Yeah.
Say that again.
Say that question. Would he consider them created in the image of God?
Because the image of God within us is the intellect. That's literally the image of God. God is intellect. You fill your cardboard box with godly knowledge. You have actualized your Tselem Elokim, your divine image. If you don't fill the cardboard box with knowledge, you have not actualized the potentiality of Tselem Elokim, of divine spark.
Image. What about degrees here? In that
PhD, master's, bachelor's.
More like how full your box is.
Right.
I mean, obviously, we're saying that perfection or near perfection is you're a prophet. Okay? But is there such a thing as some lesser degree of knowledge where you're still a person and you still have providence? And it seems like a circular argument to some extent to say, okay, if you find somebody that has bad things happening to them, well, by definition, they weren't a person because they didn't have enough knowledge.
But the Rambam would really say that in the majority of cases of bad things happening, they're happening to people who are ignorant.
But only the definition is that you have God's providence if you have enough knowledge or intelligence. Okay?
There are degrees. Yes, there are degrees.
Okay.
The Rambam says
and
to the degree that you have knowledge.
Something bad happens. Well, your excuse is, he didn't have enough knowledge.
Right. Either he didn't have knowledge at all, he didn't have enough knowledge, or, as the Rambam will say at the end of the guide, I'll give it away a little bit, that at the moment that the things happened, he was disconnected from his knowledge.
Oh, he had a leak in his box.
As we grow older, we
let me just say something, and then Harry. Obviously, it goes without saying that there's much in the Rambam's approach that is distasteful to modern men and women, and there is much that seems to be quite forced and not in accord with the Bible, with the texts. I understand that. I get it. I do get it. But on the other hand, I would like to try to take those parts of what the Rambam says that can have meaning and relevancy, and to try to see how they can enrich our understandings of Judaism and of the world. So I just want to go back to things I started to say earlier. We live in a world, let's just take America in the 21st century, in which to a certain degree, we really can see this borne out, right? People who have a college degree make more money. People who have a college degree have...
Professors who are the most...
necessarily.
More or less, right? More or less. It basically works out.
And professors who are maybe our smartest people, maybe, or some of our smartest people, make considerably less than many other...
But they still, they make more money.
Our professors are not practical.
They make more money than people who don't have any education. Now, money, of course, is not the only litmus test of success and of a good life, but it's a small part of it, and we'll get back to this later. And of course we know that people who are educated and get good jobs and learn to live their lives responsibly, they have health insurance, right? They therefore tend to either get sick less or have their maladies dealt with by modern medicine, where people who are poor to a large degree because they're not educated end up things happening to them. The Rambam takes that reality and says, look at it through a perspective of divinity. Look at the way the universe has been constructed, says the Rambam. That to a large degree, your fate is in your own hands. It's not caprice, but rather, to a large degree, depends on you. You make the effort, you do the work, you go to school, you make the sacrifices, you put your nose to the grind, and to a large degree, it's not perfect, and the Rambam will deal with those imperfections later, but to a large degree, your fate is in your own hands. Mm-hmm. The rules are clear, to a large degree. Says the Rambam, that's providence. Look at that as providence, the way God structured the universe. It's not capricious. No providence would mean that I could spend 20 years perfecting myself, going to school, acting responsibly, sacrificing for the future, and there'd be no correspondence at all between my effort and the results. But no, the world we live in is more or less, on average, it makes sense, it works. And that's providence. That's beautiful. That's astounding, says the Rambam. Look at that and be blown away by the way that God has providentially structured the universe so that things work and make sense. To me, that's powerful.
Now, if I understood what you said earlier, that the Rambam came up with these 13 principles of faith, for those people, mainly for those people,
who were unable to attain a certain degree of intelligence, a certain degree of knowledge. But if they studied and stirred these principles of faith, they would be on almost like the same level, that God would protect them.
The minimum level. Not the minimum level of protection, the minimum level of humanness, of actualization of the Tzelem Elokim.
They would at least be preparing themselves for providence.
Perhaps. I didn't say that. You're adding.
No, you didn't say that, but I have to infer that, don't I?
No, I didn't say preparing themselves for providence, preparing themselves for the minimal level of humanity. They get the broadcast to a minimum level. The 13 principles of faith are like a TV guide that tells you where to turn your radio receiver to.
Television,
you're right.
And this has nothing to do with good or evil.
Well, the Rambam, to a large degree, is conflating good and evil with knowledge and ignorance.
Right, which I don't buy. That's all right.
You'll let them do that.
Right, I understand that is a stretch in the modern mind.
Right.
And we're not going into how the Rambam does that. It's a completely different can of kosher worms. So let's go on page 476.
Back during the time period, before there was a printing press, before there was universal education, probably literacy rate was probably 2% back then. And he's implying that it's up to the individual to discover and do all these things. When this, well, no. The thing that made everything work in this world has been universal education. And
the Jewish literacy rate was much, much higher than 2%. I don't know the exact statistics, but I think it was over 50% among men. But even be that as it may.
All right. Even before the printing press, you're saying?
I think so.
Do we have anything contemporarily that would say that? Or
memory.
What?
They would memorize everything. They reduce their mind, they would develop their mind through memory and the prayers.
Yeah, but that's before the development of the printing press.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, but you know, let's stay in the in the Rambam. We're at the top of 476. We're in the middle of a sentence. Let's begin in the verse there, line 5. For not by strength shall men prevail, but to their perfection and deficiency, I mean their nearness to remoteness from God. Right here we have explicitly that perfection and deficiency of intellect is synonymous with nearness or remoteness from God. To be close to God means to have your receiver tuned to the God channel. It's about intellect. For this reason, those who are near to him, and what does near to him mean? It means
knowledgeable,
are exceedingly well protected. He will keep the feet of his holy ones. Who are his holy ones? The smart ones. Whereas those who are far from him, meaning ignorant, are given over to whatever may happen to befall them. Not that God punishes them in any kind of zapping fashion, for they just don't know what's flying. Right? And they fall and they stumble and things happen. Because, as the Rambam told us, providence does not watch over the natural events. There are volcanoes, and there are men falling, and there are buckets of paint falling from ladders, and there are pieces of cement falling from a 100-story building. Those things happen. And if you are on the proper wavelength, and you receive the divine overflow, you will avoid those happenstance events like the volcano and the chip of concrete falling from the building. But if you are not attuned to the divine overflow, then chance, in a world of chance, things happen. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but eventually the volcano will erupt on you or the chip of concrete will fall upon you. Not because God's directly punishing you, but the world is structured so that you are quote unquote punished for your ignorance, right?
The ignorance is like living close to a volcano.
Yes.
I mean, for example.
Yes, that's a good example.
Everybody in Hawaii.
But they get the most fertile land after the lava flow.
So okay, so it's a risk.
They live there, yeah.
It's a risk. For there is nothing to protect them against whatever may occur. For they are like one walking in darkness whose destruction is assured. He's going to eventually trip. With regard to providence watching over the excellent ones, it is also said, he keepeth all his bones, and so on. The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and so on. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him, and so on. The texts that occur with regard to this notion are so numerous that they cannot be counted. I refer to the notion of providence watching over human individuals according to the measure of their perfection and excellence. Right, so the Torah and the prophets and the book of Psalms, etc., are full of statements that God watches over his holy ones, his righteous ones. The Rambam has explained to us how to understand all that. Right? Assimilate all that into the framework we've created. It's all about nearness and closeness, and nearness and farness to God, which is all about intellect, which is all about connecting to the overflow, which is all about, like we said, responsible living and self-preservation. That seems to be what the Rambam is talking about.
And yet, how does the Rambam explain things that happen to these educated sages, like Akiva, for example?
Jay asked the same thing. I'm waiting.
He gave us a hint, though. Right.
Right, I gave a hint. What was the hint?
They literally lose touch with their knowledge.
Yeah. Got a loose connection.
Loose connection, yeah.
Huh? We have to wait for this. Let's not jump ahead.
You mean we're going to get it later on?
Absolutely.
Guarantee, right?
Ooh.
Ooh.
Okay, we're going to go on.
This is Jewish study. There is no guarantee.
The philosophers, too, mention this notion. Abu Nasr, who's Al-Farabi. Let me just tell you a story about this. When I studied the Rambam when I was younger, and when I studied the Rambam, of course, in university for my master's degree in Jewish philosophy, I heard mentioned quite a bit of Al-Farabi, the famous Muslim philosopher of the period, and I actually read works by him and compared them to the Rambam. And then, just 6 months ago, when we did that Jewish Muslim dinner at the Islamic Center in Richardson, there was a picture of Al-Farabi on the wall.
Wow.
Okay. So the philosophers too mention this notion. Abu Nasr said in the introduction to his comment on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, those who have the capacity of making their soul pass from one moral quality to another are those of whom Plato has said that God's providence watches over them to a higher degree. Okay. And that ends our review from last time. So you can see that the Rambam here has promulgated a theory of providence which he understands is not only something that satisfies the textual needs of the Jew, but it's also in accordance with modern philosophy, which means 12th century science. Right? Al-Farabi.
Did the Rambam consider himself a prophet?
Ooh, I'm happy you asked that question.
You must have.
I'm happy you asked that question. There's a very, very famous article of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel on the subject. And it's called, it's in Hebrew, Did the Rambam Believe That He Merited Prophecy? And it's
Rabbi, believe what?
Did the Rambam believe that he merited prophecy?
He merited prophecy.
Because, of course, according to everything we've said about the nature of prophecy, you would think that the Rambam was a near prophet. And Heschel examines the question on both sides, and he comes to the conclusion that the Rambam probably did believe that he had a certain degree of prophecy, and we're actually going to read, in another few minutes, one of the quotes that Heschel uses to buttress his argument.
I have another question.
Another question.
Did he live a long life that was free of distress?
No. The Rambam, we don't know exactly when we know he died in 1204. We're not exactly sure when he was born. Most probably lived 79 years.
Well,
which is not short.
That was a long
not
story.
Short. He had a difficult
time,
life. The Rambam,
life.
You know what? I just remember that. Did I add a decade to his life? I have a mental block here. If he was died in 1204, when would he have been born? 1134?
That would have been 70.
That's 70.
Right. So it would be 1125. Right.
Okay, so I misspoke. They're on lived to 69 years, not 79 years.
As a matter of fact, if you look at the beginning of the guide, the lieutenant here.
Yeah, the Rambam lives approximately 69 years, and not 79 years. And he did, he had quite a degree of suffering, how that could be possible. We will see, perhaps we'll get to it today. Here we are. So we are skipping from 476 to 483. And everyone has the handouts. In order, right? With the second half of 483, on the right-hand side of the page, I put a little bracket there. Little bracket. And the top of the page, it says, Guide of the Perplexed, 320. Part 3, chapter 20, page 483. The second paragraph. To sum up the notion that I have stated in resume, just as we do not apprehend the true reality of his essence, but know withal that his existence is the most perfect of existences and not commingled in any way with any deficiency or change or being acted upon. God does not change and his knowledge does not change. So although we do not know the true reality of his knowledge because it is his essence, we do know that he does not apprehend at certain times while being ignorant at others. This was a whole chapter on God's knowledge that I skipped. And it's being summarized now. To make a long story short, the Rambam says that God's knowledge, which is God himself, that's what God is knowledge, that's his essence. God's knowledge is not like our knowledge. Our knowledge is a function of the things we know. Like, why do I know that Dorothy is wearing a green blouse? Because she's wearing a green blouse. I know she is because she is. But according to the Rambam, God doesn't know that Dorothy's wearing a green blouse because she is. He knew it before she was wearing it. But God's knowledge is not a function of the things he knows. It's prior to the things he knows. And it's therefore, this is a tautology, it is by definition not at all like our knowledge. And since our knowledge is a function of the things we know, and the things we know change, so our knowledge changes. Right? I don't know what Dorothy will wear tomorrow. I only know it when I see it. But God knows what she will wear tomorrow before she wears it. God's knowledge is not a function of what he knows of Dorothy. And God's knowledge never changes. He knows right now what will happen to the end of time. And therefore his knowledge never changes. Mine changes as a function of the world changing. God's knowledge doesn't change. Our knowledge changes. And therefore, says the Rambam, God's knowledge is sui generis. It's unique. It's not at all similar to our knowledge. It's almost problematic that we use the same word for our knowledge and God's knowledge. It's two different things completely.
Well, it's pretty consistent.
First, some trivia. He was born in 1135. So you're pretty good.
Yeah.
You're pretty good. But no, the other thing, the interesting thing about that statement, and which may be even highlighted, is that Maimonides believed in empirical knowledge. For human beings. You had to observe it to know it.
Yeah.
Define that, empirical knowledge, meaning...
No, Jay, that's not important for now. The whole subject here, the reason I brought this, is not because we're studying God's knowledge. It's because the Rambam's going to now compare between God's providence and God's knowledge.
Well, it seems fairly consistent with what we've defined in the past.
It is.
If we say God is knowledge, and the essence of God is knowledge, and that people try and receive this knowledge, and the closer they get to perfect reception, the closer they get to prophecy, which is the ability to see the future, so to speak.
Among other things.
So... Right. The God being the perfect prophet.
Right, the source of prophecy.
No, God is the source. Is all knowledge.
Yes.
And so, that includes the ability to know what's going to happen.
100%.
Okay.
Well, I mean, this is very problematic because it would imply, one, that if God is, to the end of time, aware of what is going to happen, it means that our free will...
Fantastic! Thank you, Jay. I was just about to bring that up. Thank you.
A myth.
So, if everyone remembers, we're about to talk about this for 5 minutes because Jay brought it up and because it's relevant to something we learned a few weeks ago. It's not directly part of our subject, but we should cover it. The Rambam had said a few weeks ago that it's impossible to square divine knowledge of the future with human free will. He had said that, remember? He said it's impossible. And he made fun of the Islamic sects
like
that tried to,
like Rabbi Akiva,
that tried to square the circle. But this is an example of the Rambam contradicting himself, probably for didactic purposes. In the chapter that we're skipping, we're just reading its summary, the Rambam backtracks. And he says, it is possible to square divine foreknowledge and human free will because divine knowledge is not at all similar to human knowledge. It's beyond our ken of understanding what we mean when we say that God knows the future. Because God knows, that verb knows, we don't know what it means. Because God's knowing is not at all
like
our knowing. That's the Rambam's solution, as it were, to this philosophical conundrum. And of course, it's solution only in the sense he says we can't understand.
Well, it is possible because...
Now, Dorothy, let's not, please. We have to stay on subject.
Just because God knows what the person's going to choose doesn't mean that he didn't give him free will to choose.
I can't say anything. There's books and books and books and libraries and people do their doctorate just on that question. Okay, I only wanted to get to this for the comparison, the equivalency the Rambam's about to make between divine knowledge and divine providence. So here we are. So we were in the second paragraph, in the second half of 483. And let's read in the sixth line. The last two words of the sixth line. I mean. Okay? 483, second paragraph, end of the sixth line. I mean to say that no new knowledge comes to him in any way. That his knowledge is neither multiple nor finite. That nothing among all the beings is hidden from him, and that his knowledge of them does not abolish their natures. That is, their free will. For the possible means it's possible to do, it's possible not to do, that's free will. For the possible remains as it was with the nature of possibility, even though he knows what you're going to choose. All the contradictions that may appear in the union of the assertions are due to their being considered in relation to our knowledge, which has only its name in common with his knowledge. That's what I just said to Jay 2 minutes ago. And now for our point for today. Similarly, the word purpose is used equivocally when applied to what is purposed by us and to what is said to be his purpose, may he be exalted. Similarly, the word providence is used equivocally when applied to what we are provident about and to that of which it is said that he, may he be exalted, is provident with regard to it.
Rabbi, I did not understand a word of those two sentences.
Thank you, Jay. I'll go back. Okay. I was just waiting for someone to tell the truth.
Right. I was thinking almost
equivalent.
So, let's just go back to the third to last line of the previous page, 483. Similarly, the word purpose is used equivocally, in other words, with two different meanings. When applied to what is purposed by us, that's one meaning of the word purpose, comma, and to what is said to be his purpose. Right? So when we talk about us having a purpose and God having a purpose, it's two different things.
It's like from a line from Isaiah, but my ways are not your ways, and says God.
Right.
You mean sort of like the highway or the highway?
So let's just think about it. Why does the Rambam say this? We understand God's knowledge is different than our knowledge because our knowledge is contingent upon the things we know. God's knowledge is not contingent but the things he knows. He knows them before they are. So his knowledge is sui generis. It's unique. And then the Rambam says the same thing concerning purpose. Well, what do you mean, purpose? Why does the Rambam go from knowledge to purpose? Knowledge is about God's essence. Why does he suddenly start talk about God's purpose, which is a completely different thing? What's the connection?
Knowledge is the purpose. The purpose is knowledge. That the whole purpose is the ultimate purpose is knowledge. That's the ultimate goal, ultimate destination, ultimate aim is
fill your box.
Yeah, but we're talking about God's purpose.
God's purpose for humans.
Okay, but let me go further. Purpose. Listen. Purpose is about achieving a goal that is not yet achieved.
Right.
Purpose is a function of time. Right?
Right.
If there's no time, there's no purpose. Purpose is about at X time there is a lack. At X plus one time, I want that lack to be fulfilled. I want something to be accomplished. I want there to be process. Time allows process. But God's knowledge, we just said, is not a function of the things that he knows, but it's rather prior to the things he knows.
No. It's not a function of the things that he observes in there.
Okay, yes,
no,
right.
No, because God knows what's, according to what I've been hearing, knows what's going to happen in the future.
But not because it's going to happen.
No. Not... Well, wait a second. You can't have it both ways here now.
God knows what's going to happen, not because he sees what's going to happen and therefore knows it, but rather he knows it before it's going to happen.
It's all knowledge.
You're using human terms to describe.
Of course I am. I have no choice. You want me to talk in divine language?
God knows in whatever way he knows what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
Not on the basis of current observation.
Yes, and not on the basis of observing the future. It's not that he observes the future.
No, he knows however he knows.
Just a nosy person, that's all.
We have no idea.
Let me make the point here. The point is, remember, we're talking here about the Rambam moving from discussion of divine knowledge to discussion of divine purpose.
Right. Yes.
What's the connection? The connection is time. Human knowledge is a function of time. I know something only after that something happens. I knew it because it happened. My knowledge is a function of it happening. God's knowledge is not a function of what happens. It's prior to what happens.
It's outside of time.
It's outside of time.
Yeah.
Now apply that to purpose. Human purpose is a function of time. I want to accomplish something that I have not yet accomplished. If there was no time, there would be no purposefulness. God's purposefulness is not like our purposefulness in the sense that God doesn't live in time. He can't want something to happen because God doesn't live on the sphere of time.
Like the tetragrammaton, he's present in the past, present and future, and everything is all together.
Okay, and so therefore, when we talk about purpose vis-a-vis God, we have to stand back and think, what are we talking about? God can't purpose to accomplish anything because it's already accomplished. And the word "will accomplish" doesn't apply. Why is the Rambam saying this here? In order to segue to his next statement, that God's providence is not at all akin to what human beings mean when they say providence. When I watch providentially over my daughter, right? What do I mean?
Yes.
I mean that I will make sure that things that are bad don't happen in the future, in the next second, the next minute. But how could God have a providence care of that type if God is not in time?
Not a specific time.
God is beyond time.
No, he's in central time.
What do you mean beyond time?
I don't know what I mean, because I am not beyond time. But that's the Rambam's point. That's the Rambam's. You cannot understand neither divine knowledge, nor divine purpose, nor divine providence.
His very name is the verb to be, which you can pass, present, or future.
Very good, Chip. So let me just finish my thoughts here. I'm not going to go so much further with this, except to say the following. For the past few weeks, we've been gradually understanding that when the Rambam talks about divine providence, he does not at all mean what we have meant by that word for the past year in this class. It's something completely different. God's providence is not in time. It is not about God interjecting himself into time and making sure in time, at the proper time. It's not about making sure at the proper time that good things happen or bad things happen to bad people. It's rather a providence that is beyond time. It's that at the very outset, right, God set up this system so that things happen as they should. We've talked for the past half hour. What does it mean, as they should? According to our just deserts, on the basis of our
knowledge,
responsibility, proper living. But it's not about God injecting himself into time. God doesn't function in time.
Except for what about the miracles of the Bible?
So there, again, it's a different subject,
yeah.
But parenthetically,
yeah.
The Rambam explains that all of the miracles were already pre-programmed at the time of creation.
So you're really saying they're independent.
What's independent?
To God and man.
Independent only in the sense that we would normally...
The result is what God has in providence, as you're using it. But her wearing a different color shirt is irrelevant. It's what she accomplishes towards the goal or this providence of God.
I didn't completely understand.
Okay. I don't understand how they're connected, is what I guess I'm saying.
What is connected?
God and man. Or woman. I don't understand.
The connection is in absorbing the divine overflow, which we are doing every minute,
yeah.
If we are doing it.
If we study.
But it seems like it's, in terms of, when you look at the Torah, it shows that God is the God of history. And this...
Which is a big problem for the Rambam.
Yes.
Yes. I'll just say yes.
I was going to, on that same line, to say that there is no temporal aspect of God, and yet the Torah itself contradicts that because of his direct intercedence into the Garden of Eden, Mount Sinai. I mean, these are temporal things in which God's presence was there.
Right.
A before, a now, and in the future, yeah. So to speak. It seems that that idea is faulty as far as the concept of God being timeless and so forth, as we've been...
But once the Bible has been redacted, where has God been?
What if there was one more than one Adam? Or more, it wasn't the first Moses that let us out. That way that would be consistent. In other words, Adam is not Adam, Moses is not Adam. It's an individual that comes along and does what exists. I mean, that's the only way I can understand what's being expressed. I mean, I don't know if that's,
I hear. I'm wavering, but I think that we shouldn't go too far into this. It's getting us a bit off track. I just wanted to make the point that when the Rambam uses the word providence, it doesn't mean what we would attribute to the word. Okay.
What we're discovering is that in many cases, whatever we're studying isn't totally consistent with other things that we study.
That's a good point. Certainly, we're seeing different texts and different authors who don't necessarily agree with each other, might not even agree on the meaning of the words. Absolutely.
But what is then the difference between the Rambam's definition of providence and our so-called definition of providence?
Everything is different.
Yeah.
Everything.
Well, give me one specific.
But we have a basic problem.
Yeah.
We have a basic problem. If God is ineffable, which is one of Maimonides' creeds, then we don't understand him. We can't possibly understand.
You can't understand anything.
About anything. So when we talk about God's knowledge, we're playing with words, really, because we don't know how it functions. If God created time, he can live outside of time.
Yeah, let me just add to what Mo said. The Rambam's theory of negative knowledge, which means that you become closer and closer to God, to truth, to knowledge, through the progressive nullification of everything you thought to be true. In other language, you can know nothing about God, which, by the way, seems to contradict everything we've said about the broadcast and the overflow, right? I understand. You can know nothing about God. What you can do is know that you know nothing. You can progressively know more of the truth that you know nothing. Let me draw that on the board. Here's an ignorant person.
At zero.
And the ignorant person, what makes him ignorant? The fact that he thinks he has 100% of knowledge. That's what makes him ignorant. How do you become more knowledgeable? By knowing that you only have 90% of the truth. How do you become more knowledgeable? By knowing you only have 80%. When do you become completely enlightened? When you know that you know nothing.
This is George Orwell's 1984.
But it's 1,000 years before George Orwell. So the Rambam says that how do you really connect to the divine overflow? By moving yourself from here progressively to here. And when I really know that I know nothing about anything, because...
I know nothing about God.
Right. I know nothing about God.
I can know science, I can know history, but I know nothing about God.
Very good. When I know nothing, when I know that I know nothing about God, that's when I begin to know.
Well, then how does he define knowledge then, the Rambam? Because it's all he took. You know, he's an elitist. And in order to be even accepted as a human being, you got to be an intelligent person, according to the Rambam.
And the foundation of intelligence,
so how does that coincide with what
is knowledge of your ignorance?
Huh?
The foundation of knowledge of God is awareness of your ignorance.
Of God.
Of God.
No, but the point is that Rambam insists that we have to not learn Torah, but we have to learn science and philosophy. We have to learn all these things in order to come nearer to God.
That's right.
Right.
And this is the movement of nearness to God in that direction.
Why? Why? How do you come up with that rationale?
Because
the less you know about God, then the more intelligent you are. What kind of nonsense is that?
Because God is unknowable. So if you think you know, then you're ignorant.
Well,
she doesn't even know he exists.
There's a logic.
It's very powerful. Yeah. It's very powerful.
Logic to it.
Yeah. There is?
Yeah.
To me.
Well, a good example is, you know, when you first graduate, like say you get your engineering degree or your law degree, you think you know everything. You go out into practice, you realize you know nothing.
Right. Well, you got a foundation, that's all.
Yes.
Why
so,
do you have to know anything about God?
Because the whole purpose of life is to know God.
Why did you make it so hard to understand him then?
Life is full of challenges. But look, on the one hand, it is certainly true that the Rambam's theory of providence is bound up with his whole view of Torah. That's true. On the other hand, were we to try in this room to lay the foundation of the Rambam's whole view of Torah, we'd be here for 5 years. So we're really trying here.
I've been studying under you for 5 years.
So I admit that what we're trying to do here is really to square the circle. We're trying to study what the Rambam writes about providence and not read the whole guide at once, when we really are missing a lot of background. I'm trying to supply some of it. And the truth is that, of course, scholars spend their whole lives trying to figure out the Rambam's whole organic philosophy of Torah. And there are many, many differences of opinion. It's not that easy to
The more you know, you're ignorant of Maimonides.
That's really good. That's good.
No, are you going to confuse us further by taking us to Nachmanides?
I hope not. I really do. I want to go on because we have to get a big picture here. So we have a few more lines here at the top of 484. So we're reading the last five words of 483. Moving to 484. Similarly, the word providence is used equivocally when applied to what we are provident about, comma, and to that of which it is said that he, may he be exalted as provident with regard to it. Right? When you say providence, it means one thing for human beings, another thing for God. And therefore, just to summarize in one moment, it's okay that we've come to the conclusion that when the Rambam talks about divine providence, the word providence means nothing that is similar to what we thought the word meant until now. It means something different. It is accordingly true that the meaning of knowledge, the meaning of purpose, and the meaning of providence when ascribed to us are different from the meaning of these terms when ascribed to him. That's the summary. When, therefore, the two providences, right, God's and ours, or knowledges, God's and ours, or purposes, ours and his, are taken to have one and the same meaning, the above-mentioned difficulties and doubts arise. You get confused if you think that providence means for God the same thing it means for us.
How does the Rambam know what God is saying?
He's speculating.
When, on the other hand,
because he says, we don't know how God thinks. So how does he know how God thinks?
No, he doesn't know what God thinks. He only knows that he doesn't know.
No, but how does he know that God's concept of providence is different than man's concept of providence?
Because God is different. Because God is God.
God doesn't even use the word providence.
Right. Harry, you're right.
But I'm wrong, I know.
You're good.
This is tough stuff.
When, on the other hand, it is known that everything that is ascribed to us, not to human beings, is different from everything ascribed to him, truth becomes manifest. Now that sentence is really a statement of what I have on the board, right? Because we begin thinking that I can just apply my concepts to God. That's the 100%. I think that what I know applies to God. How does truth become manifest? By moving backwards. Truth becomes manifest by realizing that my language, my concepts, my understandings are only good for human beings. And the more I realize that they apply less and less to God, the closer I come to the truth. That's negative knowledge. The differences between the things ascribed to him and those ascribed to us have been explicitly stated, as been mentioned above by Chip, in its dictum, neither are your ways my ways. Right, Chip? You said
from
that?
Isaiah, yeah.
You said that 10 minutes ago. I think that the Rambam's usage of that verse from Isaiah, neither are your ways my ways, is really instructive. When you read in context, You say, yeah, it means that God is great. But the Rambam understands that verse philosophically. Neither are your ways my ways is a statement of Rambam's negative theology. That knowing is about knowing that you don't know God. This is how the Rambam philosophizes and finds a deeper level of meaning in verses that you might read pretty simply and straightforwardly in the prophets and in the Torah. So, with that, we can move on to page 486.
Is that page chapter 22?
Chapter 22.
Yeah, because the page number was
cut off. Page 486. There's no page number at the top. You're right. It says chapter 22 at the top. And now begins the Rambam's philosophic commentary in the book of Job. We've been waiting for this moment for a long time because we've studied the book of Job on the pshat level, if you will. And now comes the Rambam's philosophic commentary in the book of Job. And there's fantastic stuff here. Of course, we have to read a lot of material to find the points the Rambam is really making. I'm going to read quickly and only stop when we get to something significant. The story of Job, which is extraordinary and marvelous, belongs to the kind of things we are discussing now. It's the subject of providence. I mean to say that it's a parable intending to set forth the opinions of people concerning providence. You know the explicit statement of some of the sages, Job has not existed and was not created, but it's a parable. We saw that. We discussed that many moons ago. Those, on the other hand, who believe that he has existed and was created, and the story has happened, do not know at what time and what place he lived. For some of the sages say he lived in the days of the patriarchs. Others say he lived in the days of Moses. Again, others say he lived in the time of David. Again, others say he was one of those who came back from Babylon. Many have been in different opinions in the sages. We didn't see all this. We just saw the opinion that it's a parable. This confirms the opinions of those who say that he was not existed and was not created. In other words, some say it's a parable, some say it existed, but those who say existed have so many different opinions. When he existed, it's as if they're saying that it didn't exist. It strengthens the opinion that it's all a parable for the Rambam. It's very important to point out and to emphasize it is only, I take away the word only, it is a parable. It is meant to teach a philosophic lesson. It didn't necessarily happen. It has nothing to do with history. To sum up, whether he existed or not, with regard to cases like his, which always exist, in other words, cases of bad things happening to good people, all reflecting people become perplexed. And in consequence, such things as I have already mentioned to you are said about God's knowledge and his providence. In other words, people get confused. They see bad things happening to good people, and therefore they come up with all these strange theories of providence to try and square the circle, says the Rambam.
We know who wrote the book of Job.
We don't know. I refer to the assertion that a righteous and perfect man who is just in his actions and most careful to avoid sins was stricken without his having committed a sin entailing this by great and consecutive calamities with respect to fortune, children, and body. Right? We don't understand how to square it. Now, according to both opinions, the one that considers that he has existed and the one that considers that he's not existed, the prologue, I mean the discourse of Satan, remember the first two chapters, that of God addressed to Satan in the giving over of Job to Satan is undoubtedly, in the view of everyone, endowed with intellect, a parable. Strong statement here. Even if you hold that the book of Job is not a parable, you have to agree that at least the first two chapters are a parable. Because that Satan stuff, that's really far out. It's a parable. A parable for what? The Rambam will explain. However, it is not a parable like all others, but one to which extraordinary notions and things that are the mystery of the universe are attached. Through that parable, great enigmas are solved and truths than which none is higher than become clear. I shall mention to you what is possible to mention. I can't tell you everything, says the Rambam. I can't give away the divine secrets. I'll mention what's possible to mention. I shall mention to you the words of the sages that have drawn my attention to everything that I understand in this great parable. The first thing that you will consider is its dictum, there was a man in the land of Uz. That's the first verse, in which figures the equivocal word Uz. It is the name of an individual. He quotes Uz, his firstborn, from the book of Genesis.
Right after the Akedah. Right.
Mm-hmm. And also the imperative of a verb meaning to reflect and to meditate. Right? In Hebrew, Uz is the imperative of the word etza. Etza means to take counsel.
Advice.
Utsu etza means take counsel together. It is as if Scripture said to you, meditate and reflect on this parable, grasp its meaning, and see what the true opinion is. So the Rambam is telling us that the book of Job has deep stuff in it. You have to contemplate it, you have to meditate, you have to look deeply, and I, the Rambam, will tell you some, but not all of the truth. Because I can't tell you it all. It's just too deep, and you'll have to figure out what I mean by reading between the lines of what I do write, says the Rambam. Then it mentions that the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Remember that verse there? Right? The B'nai Elohim, the divine agents, the angels, the sons of God, whatever you call them, present themselves before the Lord, and that Satan came in their midst of their crowd and multitude. For it does not say the sons of God and Satan came to present themselves before the Lord, but it says it separately. The sons of God came to present themselves, and then the Satan. They're two separate things, says the Rambam. For which would have meant that all of them were there because of an identical relation. But it rather says the sons of God came to present themselves with the Lord, and Satan came also among them. The Satan is something different. He's separate. It's not the same thing as the other divine beings. This form of speech is only used with regard to one who has come without having been for his own sake the object of an intention, or having been sought for his own sake, but came in the midst of those who came when those whose presence was the object of an intention presented themselves. So Satan here is in some sense different, extra. Then it mentions that this Satan roamed and went over all the earth. There is no relationship whatsoever between him and the upper world, in which there is no road for him. This is the meaning of it saying, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. Thus, his going to and fro and his roaming take place on the earth. The Rambam is setting us up for an understanding that there are divine beings in the upper world, and of course the upper world is the world of intelligence, of course, for the Rambam, where Satan belongs to the lower world, and the lower world is the world of ignorance. So somehow the divine beings are indicative of, or they symbolize in this parable, knowledge, where Satan symbolizes in some sense lack of knowledge.
And yet Satan in this parable knows God. He sees him, he talks to him.
So the Rambam explains, the Rambam explains in many places that parables have lots and lots of filler in them for the story. And you have to be able to distinguish between the filler and the point. The point might be just one sentence in a whole story of 1,000 words. So for the Rambam, most of the parable is just a story. It's filler to make it palatable so that you read it, so it's interesting. But you have to find the point. And the Rambam knows the point. Then it mentions that this righteous and perfect man, that's of course Job, was delivered into the hands of this Satan, and that all the calamities that befell him with respect to his fortune, his children, his body were caused by Satan. After having made this supposition, it begins to set down, what did I just say? If Satan signifies ignorance, then what the Rambam just said is that all Job's issues are caused by ignorance. The Rambam didn't say that yet. He's hinting to it. We'll read further. After having made this supposition, begins to set down speeches of people engaged in speculation with regard to this occurrence. Thus it mentions a certain opinion, ascribes it to Job, and ascribes other opinions to his friends. I shall make them clearly known to you. I'm referring to those opinions about which there's a conflict of thought, and that are concerned with the story that cause of the whole of which was Satan. Though all of them, Job and his friends thought that God had done it himself, and not through the intermediary of Satan. Uh-oh, he just said something important. That every character in the story thinks that what happened to Job is God's doing. But the truth is it's not from God at all, it's from Satan. And Satan is a being of earth and not of heaven, he just said. And heaven signifies knowledge, and earth signifies ignorance. What he's saying is everything that happened wasn't from God, it was from ignorance. Whose ignorance?
Satan.
No.
Job.
Job's ignorance.
But Satan's influence.
But all Satan symbolizes is ignorance. He's not a separate being. So basically the Rambam is setting us up to hear the coming sentences, which the Rambam will say that Job did it to himself through his lack of connection to the divine overflow. Let's read on. The most marvelous and extraordinary thing about this story is the fact that knowledge is not attributed in it to Job. Ooh! One more sentence, or two. It's not said to be a wise... He is not said to be wise or comprehending or intelligent man. Only moral virtue and righteousness and action are ascribed to him. For if he had been wise, his situation would not have been obscure for him, as will become clear. So yes, the book says that Job was righteous, and he was upright and he was God-fearing. And although the Rambam believes that usually righteousness and God-fearingness and uprightness are part and parcel of knowledge, Job was an exception. He had all of this uprightness, but he didn't use it to gain knowledge. It was for him disconnected from knowledge. Job was ignorant. And we learned earlier, in what we studied in previous chapters of the Guide to Perplex, that the worst things can happen to ignorant people. They're not even human beings. They're like animals. Of course there's no divine providence. Or to say it differently, that's divine providence, that bad things happen to evil people because they don't watch out for themselves. That's the key already. Job is an ignorant person. The things that happened to him are caused by Satan, who signifies ignorance. We already have the beginning of an understanding of the book of Job according to the Rambam. Let's read on.
Let me ask a question before you go on. So if we were to say that Job was an intelligent, knowledgeable person, that he would have understood what was happening to him?
Okay, Harry's saying something important, and the Rambam has not told us which direction he will go in. I'll put on the table the two possibilities. Either the Rambam means that bad things happen to Job because of his ignorance, or the Rambam means that because of Job's ignorance, he didn't know how to understand the things that were happening to him. Hear the nuance there? Should I say it again?
Yeah, I got it. I can't buy it.
Don't have to buy it. Just have to absorb it.
Just be a sponge, right?
Then it gradiates his misfortune according to the various circumstances of people. For some people are not frightened by the loss of their fortunes and hold it a small thing, but are horrified by the death of their children and die because of their grief. Others support with patience without tarrying the loss of their children, but no one and dad with sensation can support pain patiently. Now all men, I mean the vulgar. Who are the vulgar? Those who don't know anything. Glorify God with their tongues and attribute to him justice and beneficence when they are happy and prosperous, or even when they are in a state of endurable suffering. Ever when the misfortune mentioned Job befall them, some of them become unbelievers and believe that there is little order in all that exists at the time when they lose their fortunes. Others hold to the belief in justice and order in spite of even having been stricken by the loss of their fortune, but do not keep patient if tried by the loss of their children. Others again are patient and keep an untroubled belief even when they lose their children. None of them supports patiently the pain of the body without complaining and repining either with the tongue or in the heart. And he's describing here, he said, ignorant people, the vulgar. The vulgar respond to bad things that happen to them with various degrees of heresy and disbelief and perplexity. That's the vulgar. But the wise don't respond like that. That's the implication, right? So the Rambam seems to be saying, the Rambam seems to be taking one of two directions of the two directions I just set forth for Harry. I said two possibilities. Either that bad things happen to Job because he's ignorant, and they wouldn't have happened had he not been ignorant, or Job is ignorant, therefore doesn't know how to parse the things that happened to him. Had he been wise, he would have known how to understand what's happening to him. The Rambam now is going in the second direction. You hear that? It's the ignorant that don't know how to deal with their misfortune.
Yeah.
deal with it as a sense of how to parse it intellectually, how to categorize it, how to understand it, relate to it. The implication being that the wise, which Job wasn't, know how to interpret what happens to them. I don't know if I should give it away or not give it away. I'm not going to give it away. Let's wait till the Rambam says it. The dictum of Scripture referring to the sons of God says in the two paths.
He also brings out an important point. There's a difference between losing your fortune and losing your children.
It's different for different people. Some other people, it's harder to do one
of them. Well, but there is a heck of a difference.
Yeah, but the Rambam says, he implies the wise know how to deal with all these things.
He does.
That's what he says. That's what he implies.
I want to meet a wise person who has lost a child.
The dictum of Scripture referring to the sons of God says in the two passages to present themselves before the Lord. Satan, however, though he came among their crowd and multitude a first and second time, is not said in the first pass to present himself. In the second pass, however, it says, and Satan came also among them to present himself to the Lord. Understand this notion, consider how extraordinary it is, and Dorothy, this next line is for you, and see how these notions came to me through something similar to prophetic revelation.
Similar.
Right, the Rambam, in his understanding of Job, tells us that he feels himself to be almost on the level of a prophet, because he has a flash of inspiration, of understanding, of some deep, deep truth that he sees hidden in the book of Job. For the meaning of the words to present themselves before the Lord is that they exist, etc., etc., etc. Let us just read the last sentence of this paragraph. It is consequently manifest the status of the sons of God and that of Satan and what exists are not identical. For the sons of God are more permanent and lasting, while Satan also has a certain portion below them what exists. And like we've said, Satan symbolizes ignorance, whereas the sons of God symbolize knowledge. Furthermore, one of the marvels of the parable consists in the fact that when it mentions that Satan roams especially over the earth and accomplishes certain actions, it also makes clear that he is forbidden to gain dominion over the soul, that he has been given dominion over all terrestrial things, but that he is kept away by a barrier from the soul. This is the meaning of it. What it says, only spare his soul. That's what God said to Satan. I would explain to you that in our language, the term soul is equivocal and applied to the thing that remains of man after death. It's the thing over which Satan had no dominion. In other words, in context, when God says to Satan, spare his soul, there the word soul means life. Like we say in English, there is not a soul in sight. I just mean a human being. Spare his life. But the Rambam says the deeper meaning, spare his soul, is spare his cardboard box. Spare his knowledge. Spare that which exists him after death, which is your knowledge. So what is the Rambam saying? He's saying the same thing he said earlier from a different point. He's saying that the Satan, again symbolizing
ignorance,
can't touch your knowledge. If you have knowledge, there's no Satan. When do you have Satan? When there's no knowledge. So now it's getting late. So I will summarize for you the next paragraph. Paragraph takes up the whole page. And actually, it takes up the whole end of the chapter. I don't want to end in the middle, so I'll summarize it for you. The Rambam now brings the statement of Reish Lakish from the Talmud that says that Yetzer Hara and Malach HaMavit and Satan are the same thing. Into English, that the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse, and the angel of death, and the Satan are the same thing. And the Rambam goes on to explain what it means. He also goes on to bring the song we sing Friday night, Shalom Aleichem. If you know the story, Shalom Aleichem, we sing to the angels. And the song goes, there's a good angel and a bad angel. The story goes, good angel and bad angel walks home with you from shul, and everything is set out properly on the table. Then the good angel says amen, and the bad angel has to accept it with sadness, and you sing Shalom Aleichem to the angels and say, look what I have, you know, accept what I have. But the idea is, the Rambam says, the good angel is Yetzer HaTov, and the bad angel is Yetzer Hara.
Are we attributing Satan then to be an angel, even though a fallen one?
I don't know about fallen.
It's how Christians refer to him.
It's something within us.
But the word angel, of course, is problematic.
It's a messenger.
So here we're saying the following. The Satan in the book of Job, according to the Rambam, is Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse. For the Rambam, the evil impulse is the impulse of ignorance. It's ignorance. And Job was an ignorant person.
Then Job was so ignorant, how did he become so wealthy?
And why don't we end with the answer to Harry's question according to the Rambam? Apparently the Rambam is telling us that from the book of Job we learn insight above and above, beyond the things we've learned until now. Until now we talked about how knowledge can help you to live responsibly and avoid many of the pitfalls and chance evil occurrences of this world. Now in the book of Job, the Rambam is about to show us a new, almost prophetic insight, which is the following. That all the evils that happen to the world, in the world, are perceived by us as evil only when we lack knowledge. But someone who has full insight into the meaning of life doesn't view the evils that befell Job as evil at all. No, not in that sense.
No.
In the sense of, it's all of these evils happen on the level of the material, of the corporal, but not on the level of the spiritual. Job wouldn't have complained to God, wouldn't have come to blasphemy, if he had understood that all these evils are not evil at all, and they really have no meaning, and it really doesn't matter if you have much wealth or little wealth. And it doesn't even matter, according to the Rambam, if you have many children or no children. And it doesn't even matter if you're sick or not sick. What you need is the perspective to understand that all these things are of no consequence. They don't matter. They're not evil at all. And the Rambam will explain to us, I'm just saying this now because we have to finish. He'll explain in the future that the end of the book, when it says that God gave to Job many, many new possessions and new children, the Rambam hints that what it really means is that God allowed, through the overflow, Job to understand that the things he lost are of no consequence. And therefore, it's as if he didn't lose them. Because he never really had them. Because they're not really yours. Your possessions are not really yours. They don't matter. Your children are not really yours, they don't matter. Your wealth, even your health, doesn't matter. All that matters is knowledge of God. And as soon as Job understood that, it's as if he got everything back. It's not that he really got it back. Just realizes that it doesn't matter if he has it or doesn't have it.
That's a bad philosophy.
And that's just a hint of a hint that the Rambam will hint at.
Okay. Well, we need at least one more class to talk about that.
Yes, we do.
And I regret I'm going to have to miss that class.